And as we turn to the third chapter of Esther, we are introduced for the first time to the very person who designed the Jews' overthrow, which the Lord, of course, knew all along and was placing his servants in the correct place to be there at the right time. But probably until this occasion, they didn't know why. In the book, we wouldn't have known why. Now, Pink says of Elijah as he introduces his book that he appears on the stage of history unannounced and with nothing that we're told about his ancestry. He was the great hero. But the great villain was introduced with just a modicum. We told his father's name and his lineage. But otherwise, we know nothing about him, nor even the reason for which he was promoted. But we find him as the Jews' enemy, the one who desires to do everything he can to overthrow the Jews. Now, he is called the Agagite or Agagite. And the word Agagite doesn't occur anywhere in the scriptures except for in this chapter and concerning Haman. But the name of King Agag does. So if we want to know all about Agag, then we only need to turn to two scriptures. The first of them in 1 Samuel 15 and verse 8. We read that Saul took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. Now, you know the story, how anathema that was to God and to Samuel, and how that Samuel came and rebuked Saul. And at the end of that chapter, in verse 32, that's 1 Samuel 15 and verse 32. Then said Samuel, bring ye hither to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came unto him delicately. And Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. And Samuel said, as thy sword has made women childless, so shall thy mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. Now, there's only one other reference to Agag, and that's in Numbers 24:7. In Numbers 24 and verse 7. Now, I'm not just being general, I am leading up to something, believe it or not. But in Numbers 24:7, we've got Balaam's prophecy, and it is about 373 years before the incident of Saul and King Agag. But in Numbers 24, and we look particularly at verse 7, we read, of Israel, he shall pour the water out of his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. It looks as if Agag was rather like the name Pharaoh, and was the name given to the kings of the Amalekites, or at least some of them, down the years. For that was, as I said, 373 years before the Agag with which Saul was involved. Now, just momentarily, I want to take you on another tack. And I want you to look up with me, if you will, Genesis 36 and verse 12. As I say, I am actually coming to the point bit by bit. But in Genesis 36 and verse 12, these are the generations of Esau. And in verse 8, we're told Esau is Edom. Edom means red, named, I think, after Esau, who came out all hairy and red-haired all over when he was born. Of Esau, the father of the Edomites in Mount Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Adar, the wife of Esau; Reuel, the son of Beshemoth, the wife of Esau. And the sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, and Gatim and Kenaz. And Timnah was concubine to Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bare to Eliphaz Amalek, the father of the nation. Now, we notice, therefore, that the Amalekites were descendants of Shem. And I was going to say that we have this tremendous example in Esther of anti-Semitism, talking about the Jews, the Hebrews, who were descended from Shem, the anti-Shemites. But of course, Amalek was a Shemite. However, he descended not from Jacob, but from Esau. And I think it's fair to say that anti-Semitism refers to being against the Jews, strictly the ones who descended from Jacob, and not the ones who descended from Esau. So we're going to see, I think, that in Agag we have an anti-Semitic view of life. Now, I'd like you also to look with me at Exodus chapter 17 and verse 6. Sorry, verse 16. Without telling you the whole story, the Lord says in Exodus 17, verse 16, the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. On the one hand, there seems to have been this inborn feeling among the Amalekites that they hated the Jews. On the other hand, the Lord, from generation to generation, was against the Amalekites. We hear about them from time to time. There was the young man who'd been ill and was found by David and had been servant to an Amalekite. They were always around. They were never totally subdued. And when we find that Haman is described as an Agagite or an Agagite, the meaning seems to suggest that it was well known that he had descended from the royal line of the kings of Amalek. We can't, of course, be certain, but this looks, bearing in mind there is no other references in Scripture to Agag, this seems to be the most straightforward inference that can be made. And if he was an Amalekite, then the Lord would be hostile to him on his side. If you would just look patiently with me to the last book of the Old Testament, to Malachi. In the last few words of the long verse 4, Malachi 1 and verse 4, that the Amalekites are the people against whom the Lord hath indignation forever. So, as we begin to think of this man, who is hostile to the Jews, we bear in mind that this is part of the ongoing indignation of the Lord against the Amalekites and their representatives, the victory he will give to his people, the Jews. So King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. Now, would you also look with me to Daniel chapter 6? Daniel chapter 6. I'm going to read quite a proportion of it because it's very relevant to what we're looking at. What we find in Daniel 6 was only 58 years before the events of Esther. There were then 120 provinces. There are now 127. But on the whole, the situation is parallel. Now, Haman was promoted to be the leader of the princes. And in Daniel 6, we are reading that Daniel was promoted to be the leader of the princes. You can see for yourself, as happens in countries today and our own country over the years, that in the space of 58 years, the quality of leadership and the quality of advice has deteriorated considerably. But in Daniel 6, we read, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. And over these, three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. Now, what happens to Daniel did not happen to Haman. In other words, there was a much greater antipathy to the Jewish race in 58 years' time after this. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto him, King Darius, live forever. Now, what I'm wanting you to notice here, and the reason for this extended quote, is how gullible the kings were to introduce on bad advice laws that couldn't be overthrown by the rule of the kingdom. You think that was such a serious matter, every king would take it seriously. Well, notice, just as in the story that we're going to read of Ahasuerus, it's just the same with Darius. Verse 7. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains, have consulted together to establish a royal statute, really, and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Wherefore King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in the chamber towards Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making before his God. Then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. Got the king trapped, you see. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, backhanded flattery, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Then answered they and said before the king, that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petitions three times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, you might think it would read, was sore displeased. But actually, it reads, was sore displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. The king is caught. Can't deliver Daniel, though he's king, because he's been inveigled into making it a law which cannot be changed. You remember now that he had a sleepless night, that immediately it was morning, he went down to the den of lions, and he found that God had kept Daniel, and he had the advisors put to death. But I want you to look at verse 25 onwards, because this is very significant. So this is Daniel 6, verse 25. Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. This is a global kingdom, you see. Peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree. That is, done it without advice, that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. You can see Daniel's teaching here. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. What I really wanted you to notice was, of course, the law of the Medes and Persians cannot be changed. That law was still on the statute book. But it's very conveniently ignored by the princes who advise Ahasuerus. So we find that this man, Haman, was promoted and given his seat above all the princes that were with him. Now, we were told in Daniel 6 that Daniel was promoted because of the excellent spirit that was in him. Though I said that the standard had declined somewhat, I think we must do the king credit of coming to the conclusion that this man, Haman, had an excellent spirit of advice. Of course, the definition of excellence comes into this. If the king wanted to hear about the destruction of the Jews, then of course his advice was excellent. It would not have been the excellent advice he wanted to hear if his view was contrary to it. But we must assume, I think, that Haman was promoted because he was clever. He was good at his advice. It's really interesting that when you read in chapter 1, for example, that there were these two groups of advisors, his servants and chamberlains, and the princes. And no mention is here made, approximately 4 years later, princely advisors. The whole scene has changed. Why, we do not know. Whether they were opposed to King Ahasuerus over the battles of Salamis and going to war against the Greeks, so he sacked the lot? Well, we don't know at all. But now we find Haman, whose name isn't mentioned before, and we never hear of Memucan and the others whom we've already heard about. So this man was placed above all the others. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman. Did they do that to Daniel? The answer is no. He wouldn't allow it. It looks as if what Haman has been promoted to is to be an object of religious worship. If he was the major prince, they didn't need a word from the king for them to reverence him. But to bow, implying that he was a lesser deity than the king, but still a god, that would need the king's authority. And we read in verse 2, for so had the king commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Now we've seen how wonderful a person Mordecai is, how true and how honest and how good. And the impression you get is that Mordecai here was just being moody, just being awkward. He just didn't choose to bow. The reason he didn't choose to bow, and the reason why we suddenly read that they told him he was a Jew, is because he explained why he didn't bow. There is only one God, and he was the God of the whole world, and he was the God of the Jews, and he was a Jew. We're seeing in these days the bowing of the knee. The only appropriate person to bow the knee to is the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. We must not bow the knee in any other circumstance or to any other person. Serve the Lord, Psalm 2, with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son. Now that was the going down on one knee and the Son holding out his hand and the lesser monarchs kissing his hand as a sign of fealty. One knee counts as kneeling, and this is what they did. So the reason that Mordecai did not bow was because he would not reverence Haman. He had but one God. And the deep-seated hatred of the Amalekites towards the Jews and God's great indignation against them is something that was deep in the psyche here. Haman probably poured scorn on just punishing Mordecai, but going for all the Jews without exception was because, as a mean man, he knew that none of the Jews throughout the kingdom would give him that reverence. He was stupid. He was blinded by his lust for power, lust to be thought to be somebody. Because if you put all the Jews together, they wouldn't outnumber all the other people in the kingdom. And if it was worship he wanted, he could have the worship of a few million. But no, he must vent his wrath upon the whole nation of the Jews. Because none of them, he concluded rightly, would bow down and reverence him. Now the Jews were always known, and up to this time had been known, that they would support the kingdom where they were. They weren't a people who were not going to mix. And the kingdom of the Medes and Persians, in some ways, was a very generous kingdom. It let all the nations that it subjugated worship the gods of their choice. See? To preserve their own languages. He didn't force one language upon them. And so it was that Mordecai hatched this plan in revenge for the one man, but the one man of representing a whole body, a swathe of people throughout the nation, because of he wouldn't get the worship he desired. He was full of anger. But when people are angry, when people are envious, when people are eaten up with any of those powerful emotions, they begin not to think straight. It surely was public knowledge that the queen was a Jewess. Now, earlier on, we're told that Esther, the future queen, was brought, not by Mordecai, but brought probably by those who'd gone out to press gang. But the interest that Mordecai had shown into her day after day, inquiring after her welfare, surely would not have gone unnoticed by the same people that had reported to Mordecai. Surely he should have seen, had he been in his right mind, that he was sowing the seeds of his own destruction. And this is the way that God deals with people who are against him, people with whom he has great anger. He takes away the sight, the common sense, and they can't do the things that they thought they were going to do. So we proceed in this story that this is all going to happen in the first month, in the month of Nisan. And it's the 12th year now of King Ahasuerus. And they cast lots, the name is pure in the Persian, from day to day. Now by that is meant that they did it on one day, but they cast lots to see which day would be the best to kill the Jews. Would it be the 10th of the month, the 11th of the month, the 12th of the month? So they went through it. Would it be the 1st of the next month, the 2nd of the next month? And they cast the lots for each of them right through. And it wasn't until they got to the 12th month, the month Adar, the 13th day of the month, that however they discerned it, they found that the lot, the poor, fell right on that day. That was their lucky day. That was the day, therefore, that they would persecute the Jews. On the 13th of the 12th month, Adar. It's worth noticing that when they were called, I'll mention it again, but in case I forget, I'll mention it now, that when he called the scribes together, it was the day of the Passover. You remember that they were to start on the 10th of the month of Nisan and keep the Passover lamb to the 14th. And this was enacted on the 13th. Oh, deliberately, undoubtedly. Deliberately to offend the Jews as best he could, without a doubt. So Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, got this same double-forked tongue advice that they gave to Darius in years. But Ahasuerus didn't have his wits about him either. Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom. Nothing unusual there. Most people were like that. But their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws, untrue. Therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. Now it is true that the Jews kept to themselves for their worship and mixed on the whole only with themselves, except for trading and other purposes. But all this was putting the Jews in the worst possible light. And he hasn't said to the king that it's, if it pleased the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. Wouldn't you think the king might think about this for a week? Pray about it for a bit? The king had tried to destroy the Greeks and extend his kingdom beyond 127 provinces. But this is the destruction of a nation within his kingdom. Should not the alarm bells have been ringing? He too was blinded. We read, of course, that all power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Well, he was the absolute monarch and was corrupted. But Haman, who was not of his authority, whom you might say, well, all power corrupts, and he did have a lot of power. Actually, he was part of each. Of Haman, it was true that all power corrupted and absolute power corrupted him completely. The absolute being up to the standard that the king allowed. Well, if it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver. The commentators all say that was millions of pounds, even 300 years ago. Where he got it from, how he came by it, whether he somehow had inherited and kept from the king all the treasures of the Amalekite nation, there's no means of telling, but it was a lot of money. And the king was very wealthy, of course. He was the richest of all the kings that there ever were, of the Medes and the Persians. But he says he will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business. He'll pay for them. He'll pay for all their equipment. He'll pay for all their time, for everything that is involved. How personal that hatred was. And the king took off his ring, which was a sign of great approval. And he said, the silver is given to thee. In other words, don't bother about the money. The people also, they can share and do with them as it seems good to thee. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month. So they would have been in the middle of observing Passover, day before they'd eat the lamb. Deliberately, I'm sure. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month. And there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants, to the governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people of every province, according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus was it given and sealed with the king's ring. Now it's worth looking at this verse. We've mentioned already the expertise that the kings of the Medes and Persians had in keeping civilian control without the army over all its people. Now there were lots of different nations represented. And see how they ordered it. The king's scribes were called, and they were to write in all the languages of all the people. So the tribes, the scribes that were kept, there was one for every language, if not two of them. Probably what Daniel did for a large portion of what he did. Scribes have always been important. John Milton was in our own country. But you see, this was the setup. They wrote to the king's lieutenants. These will be the rulers of each of the 127 provinces. And to the governors that were over every province. So, if you like, it was to the Lord Lieutenant of Suffolk and the political boss of Suffolk. Can't quite put it quite right like that, but these were the two levels of to the rulers of every people of every province. And to the governors that were over every province. And the rulers of every people. That's the local county council. And it went through the chain of command. And the people who looked after the provinces knew the languages of their people or knew what they were. And so the letters were sent initially to the governors, and then it, to the lieutenants, then it went to the governors, and then it went to the rulers of every people. And it was a swift and efficient way of controlling the kingdom, of getting the post out to the kingdom. It's thought to have been on horseback, though some thought it may have been by runners. Verse 13, the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces. Now, what is noticeable here is that the Jews, who three generations beforehand had come out of Babylon, and then those who had been subsequently conquered, and the Israelites, probably included in this, the other 10 tribes, they had scattered from one end of this kingdom to the other, to India, as well as the Egyptian end. And that there would be a Jewish enclave in every province, scattered everywhere throughout the whole of his kingdom. Secular history tells us that there were many, many Jews in Ahasuerus' army, happy to belong to the kingdom, but Jewish in their descent. So the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little and children and women, in one day. I wonder how much the scribes enjoyed writing that. Well, the copy of the writing for a commandment was given in every province and published unto all the people that they should be ready against that day. Now, do you remember in the story of Job, The introduction was that his owner's property was destroyed, and then his health was brought low. But in every case of the property, one was left. In other words, Satan wreaked the utmost emotional difficulty upon Job, on Job. There was one who could come back to tell him of the rest of the disaster in every case. And that, of course, was very hurtful. And in this case, you see, there are 11 months to go before this will happen. 11 months of misery from the Jews, where they go out of the kingdom. They couldn't run anywhere, they couldn't go anywhere. And they even went into Shushan, the palace. Or at least they were given out there so that any Jews serving there would know that the same thing was decreed against them. And the king and Haman sat down to drink. They didn't care. They didn't care the misery of the lives of all these people or anything else. But the chapter ends with these words. But the city Shushan was perplexed. And I can only say that that reminded me of Revelation 16. Sorry, Revelation 12. And you remember how there appeared a great wonder in heaven in that chapter, the dragon ready to snatch up the Lord Jesus Christ and destroy him. And eventually when the Lord Jesus was out of his reach, he turned his wrath upon the remnant of the Lord's people. And it's described that he sent out of his mouth, verse 15, Revelation 12, 15, and the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. That's the church. And the earth helped the woman. Now, there are things which, what we might call in inverted commas, decent people in every time find it difficult to stomach. They weren't Jews. They weren't going to be affected. Except in as much as maybe it would fall upon them to do some of the killing. But they were perplexed. Should they? Shouldn't they? What was the right thing to do in this situation? Straightforward to the king? It was now a law of the land. But the ordinary people, even in the capital, were perplexed. Help didn't come from there, but all the help came from the Lord. But sympathy and understanding came from there. And when you think of the 11 months wait there was going to be, maybe that sympathy had a value that was very important to the Jews. Maybe they thought that perhaps they'd help them. Maybe they just would have an extra sympathy, a shaking of the hand or whatever with them. But the city was perplexed. I suspect in our land today, there are multitudes perplexed over LGBT, over two men, two women getting married. And the law enacted. Law? But it perplexes the ordinary people. They wish it wasn't. They don't know if they can do anything about it except pray. But of course these were godless people. But the Jews afraid, no doubt, as we shall read. May the Lord help us in the background, the understanding of how he works everything together for good. He did then because he does now. And we must trust him in every way for these things. Thank you, John.